Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Essential supplies have been delivered to thousands of people in the Ukrainian city of Kherson for the first time since the war began, UN humanitarians said on Monday. Aid workers brought food, water, hygiene kits, shelter materials, and critical household items, such as bedding, thermal blankets, and solar lamps, to more than 6,000 people in the city, which returned to Ukrainian control last Friday after Russian troops withdrew. Russian forces occupied Kherson during the first weeks of the war. UN humanitarian coordinator Denise Brown said the people of Kherson are struggling to meet their basic needs, only adding to the trauma of having endured months of constant bombardments, being forced to flee their homes, and seeing their loved ones being killed or injured. The city faces a shortage of water and electricity, while markets are running low on food and health facilities lack medicines. A steep rise in civilian casualties in Somalia, due largely to attacks by the Al-Shabaab armed group, is exacerbating an already grim human rights and humanitarian situation there, said the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on Monday. The latest figures from the UN show that at least 613 civilians have been killed and 948 injured so far this year, the highest number since 2017 and more than a 30% rise from last year. Improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, have been responsible for most of the casualties, more than 90% attributable to Al-Shabaab. Volker Türk is calling on all parties to the conflict to uphold their obligations under international humanitarian law and to ensure that civilians are protected. A lack of testing facilities and poor access to healthcare are some of the reasons that less than half of people living with diabetes in the African region know that they have the condition. Analysis released on Monday by the World Health Organization, or WHO, shows that a lack of awareness about diabetes raises the risk of severe illness and death. This potentially worsens the situation in the region, which already has the world's highest mortality rates due to the disease. Currently, 24 million adults are living with diabetes in Africa. The figure is projected to rise by 129% to 55 million by 2045. Premature deaths from diabetes in the region stands at 58%, higher than the global average of 48%. In addition, only 1 in 2 people living in Africa with type 1 diabetes has access to insulin treatment. WHO says that the rising prevalence of the disease is a wake-up call to reinforce healthcare, improve diagnosis and access to life-saving diabetes medicines, and prioritize diabetes as a major health challenge. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The United Nations General Assembly has approved a resolution calling on Russia to pay reparations for its invasion of Ukraine and other violations of international law. A little less than half of the General Assembly's 193 members voted in favor of the resolution, while 14 voted against it, including Russia, Iran, and China. 73 countries abstained, including Brazil, India, and South Africa. Ahead of Monday's vote, Ukraine's UN ambassador said it was time to hold Russia accountable.
Accounts of atrocities committed by Russians in the occupied territories, murder, rape, torture, forced deportation, looting, they all speak for themselves. Millions of Ukrainians have been forced to leave their homes and seek shelter elsewhere. Ukraine will have the daunting task of rebuilding the country and recovering from this war.
President Joe Biden said Monday he does not believe China is preparing to invade Taiwan. Biden's remarks at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, came after his first face-to-face meeting as president with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Speaking to reporters after their three-hour talk, Biden dismissed his critics' claims that U.S. military maneuvers in the Taiwan Strait are provoking a new Cold War.
I absolutely believe there need not be a new Cold War. I've met many times with Xi Jinping, and we were candid and clear with one another across the board. And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan.
Here in Egypt, imprisoned British Egyptian writer and technologist Ala Abdel Fattah has ended his hunger strike after more than 7 months. The news came in a letter from prison today to his family. They're scheduled to have their monthly visit with him on Thursday, one day before his 41st birthday. In the letter, Ala wrote, quote, "I'll see you on the visit day and tell you everything then, and we'll get back to long letters after the visit. The important thing is I want to celebrate my birthday with you on Thursday. I haven't celebrated for a long time and want to celebrate with my cellmates. So bring a cake, normal provisions. I've broken my strike. I'll explain everything on Thursday. Lots of love. I miss you and long for your company, Ala." In response, his sister Mona Saif said, quote, "I feel cautiously relieved now knowing that at least he's not on hunger strike. But my heart won't really be settled until Thursday when my mother and sister see him with their own eyes." The Biden administration has opened an FBI investigation into the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian-American journalist who was shot in the head and killed last May while covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Even as she wore a helmet clearly labeled press, Israeli officials initially blamed Palestinians for her death, then called evidence inconclusive, before once again changing their story in September to say Abu Akleh may have been accidentally hit by Israeli troops. But eyewitness accounts and videos of the area where Shireen was killed do not show a gun battle, and investigations by Al Jazeera, The New York Times, CNN, and other news outlets also challenge the official Israeli version of Abu Akleh's killing. Abu Akleh's family called the U.S. investigation an important step toward accountability, writing, "It is what the United States should do when a U.S. citizen is killed abroad, especially when they were killed like Shireen by a foreign military," unquote. Israel's Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz, called the U.S. decision to investigate Shireen's killing a grave mistake, adding, quote, "I have made it clear to the U.S. that we won't cooperate with any external investigation and won't allow any interference in Israel's internal affairs," he said. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, fighting between the army and M23 rebels has moved closer to the eastern city of Goma. It's some of the worst violence in Congo's North Kivu region since government forces chased the rebels into neighboring Rwanda in 2013. The fighting has pushed thousands of internally displaced people into makeshift camps where they face dangerous and squalid conditions.
The M23 attacked us the day before yesterday, and that's how we immediately made the decision to flee. I even left my wife and children behind. I didn't even take clothes. I don't have food here, and the hunger will kill us.
According to the United Nations, at least 188,000 people have been displaced in eastern Congo in recent weeks. Over the weekend, Kenya's military began sending 900 troops to Congo in support of government forces. Back in the United States in Arizona, Democrat Katie Hobbs has been elected governor after nearly a week of ballot counting in the highly contested race. Hobbs narrowly defeated her Republican Trump-endorsed challenger, Carrie Lake, with 50.39% of the votes. Lake, a former news anchor and loyal supporter of Trump's false claims of a rigged 2020 presidential election, received 49.61% of the vote. Hobbs served as Arizona's Secretary of State and vocally defended Arizona's election system and the legitimacy of the 2020 election, making her the target of harassment from the far right. Ahead of November 8th, Carrie Lake would not say whether she would accept the results of the election if she lost. On Monday night, just after major news organizations called the race for her opponent, Carrie Lake tweeted, quote, "Arizonans know BS when they see it." In more news from Arizona, voters have passed a ballot measure that will grant undocumented students in-state college tuition and scholarships if they attended high school in Arizona. The historic victory comes after a massive organizing campaign led by undocumented advocates who for years fought for state benefits. Nearly 16 years ago, Arizona overwhelmingly voted to ban undocumented students from getting in-state tuition. A federal appeals court has temporarily blocked the Biden administration's student loan relief program while it reviews a lawsuit by six Republican-led states. The challenge is being pushed by Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, and South Carolina, arguing Biden's plan to cancel up to $20,000 in student debt per person would deprive these states of tax revenue. The program had already been put on hold even after the Education Department had approved 16 million borrowers for up to $20,000 of relief out of 26 million who have applied for the program. In the largest higher education strike in U.S. history, some 48,000 graduate student workers at all 10 University of California campuses walked off the job Monday, denouncing the university's bad faith bargaining practices with their union. The student workers, including researchers, teaching assistants, and tutors, have organized with the United Auto Workers and are fighting for higher wages, more child care benefits, expanded family leave, among other demands. The University of Virginia lifted a campus-wide shelter-in-place order Monday after police arrested a suspect in Sunday evening's mass shooting following a 12-hour manhunt. A 22-year-old former football player and UVA student is accused of killing three other football players and wounding two other people. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been nearly 600 mass shootings and 39,000 gun deaths in the United States so far this year. The U.S. Supreme Court has paved the way for the House January 6 committee to subpoena the records of Kelly Ward, the chair of Arizona's Republican Party, who played a key role in efforts to overturn Joe Biden's win in the 2020 presidential election. Two justices, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, dissented from Monday's emergency ruling without citing reasons. Clarence Thomas's refusal to recuse himself from yet another January 6 ruling has led to renewed calls for his impeachment. Justice Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, is a far-right activist who played a key role in efforts to keep Donald Trump in the White House after he lost the election. Meanwhile, former Vice President Mike Pence told ABC News in an interview broadcast Monday that Trump's actions on January 6 endangered his family, as well as everyone at the Capitol that day. Pence said he was angered over Trump's tweet on January 6 that Pence, quote, didn't have the courage to do what should have been done.
And I said, it doesn't take courage to break the law. It takes courage to uphold the law. I mean, the president's words were reckless. It's clear he decided to be part of the problem.
Pence granted ABC News the interview just as he published his new memoir entitled So Help Me God. Today, Donald Trump is expected to announce from his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, that he's running for the presidency again in 2024. Amazon's planning to carry out massive layoffs, could cut as many as 10,000 jobs this week. That's according to multiple news outlets, including the Washington Post, which reports the layoffs are likely to target Amazon's corporate workforce. This follows recent mass layoffs at Facebook, Twitter, and Salesforce. Meanwhile, prices of digital currencies fell sharply over the weekend after the leading cryptocurrency exchange, FTX, filed for bankruptcy on Friday. FTX's rapid collapse has been compared to the implosion of Lehman Brothers in 2008 and the Ponzi scheme masterminded by Bernie Madoff. Overnight, it wiped out nearly all the wealth of 30-year-old CEO Sam Bankman-Fried, whose personal net worth was once valued at $26 billion. Regulators in the U.S. and the Bahamas have opened civil and criminal investigations into how hundreds of millions of dollars worth of assets flowed out of FTX just ahead of its collapse. In more tech news, Google has agreed to pay nearly $400 million to settle 40 states' lawsuits accusing the tech giant of tracking smartphone users' movements even after they changed the software setting to opt out of sharing their location data. In a statement announcing the settlement, Oregon's attorney general said, quote, for years, Google has prioritized profit over users' privacy. And over a dozen climate scientists and advocates were arrested last week as they blocked several U.S. airports protesting the destructive toll private jets have on the environment. Climate protesters targeted private airports in New Jersey, North Carolina, California, and Washington State as part of a coordinated global action that also saw demonstrations at least 13 other private airports in 12 other countries. Among the protesters arrested was Peter Kalmus, a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab.
I feel so awful doing this. It's just, I feel sick at heart. It just feels like incredibly messy. I feel gaslit by society, but I know this is the right thing to do. So despite the messiness of this moment, I am standing in solidarity with all of the Earth protectors around the world and with all of the young people who feel desperate for their future.
To see our interview with Peter Kalmus, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up from this UN climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh to a climate of fear in the rest of Egypt, we'll talk to leading Egyptian human rights advocate Hossam Bakhet. Stay with us.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record on November 10th, full election results are not in, but we know a few things about corporate media election coverage, a big one being the over-reliance on predictive polling and expert guessing, as opposed, and really they do seem to be opposed, to time spent listening to a wide range of people about what concerns them, the uplifting of those concerns, and then an interrogation of the power players, all of them, including the no comment crowd, about how those concerns are being addressed. And if they aren't, why not? One such concern right now could have been the affordable housing crisis. As Eric Horowitz noted at Fair.org, a lot of elite media coverage of housing problems has focused on the idea that landlords of supposedly modest means are being squeezed, or that people living without homes pose a threat to the lives and property of housed citizens, as well as to the careers of politicians who dare to defend them. Besides, you know, dragging down neighborhood aesthetics. But new views are needed not only about the impacts of the affordable housing crisis, but also about its causes. It's not just capitalism run amok, because that doesn't happen without government involvement. We'll talk with longtime affordable housing advocate Gene Slater, founder and chair at CSG Advisors. Also on the show, media continue to toss off the term inflation as the reason for higher prices, as if in hopes that folks will stop their brains right there and blame an abstract entity. We'll have a quick listen back to our February conversation with Rakeen Mahboud of Groundwork Collaborative, when media were working hard to tell the public that supply chain disruptions dropped from the sky like rain, rather than being connected to decades of conscious policy decision-making. Combined corporate and government choices and how they affect the rest of us, this week on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Home ownership is a key ingredient in what is still called the American dream. Beyond the meaningful symbolism of having one's own patch, home ownership is instrumental in wealth creation, the difference between living paycheck to paycheck and being able to think about the future. It's societally important, historically important, who is encouraged and enabled and facilitated in their ability to buy a home and who is shut out. This is why many people are looking with worry at the phenomenon of institutional investors, Wall Street, gobbling up a larger and larger percentage of homes, and particularly entry-level homes, the very ones first home buyers would be looking at as affordable. What's the impact of this in the neighborhood and in the wider world? Gene Slater has worked on issues of affordable housing for many years. He's chairman and founder of CSG Advisors. He joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin, Gene Slater.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, this is something new, right? Institutional investors haven't traditionally looked at single-family homes as, like, you know, pork bellies to add to the portfolio. So why are we seeing this now?
Well, I think this started, and you're right. I mean, traditionally there have been many tens of millions of ma-and-pa small landlords, but the idea of Wall Street with virtually unlimited access to cash buying up single-family homes is a recent phenomenon. It started in some way, you know, in 2010 after the financial crisis, in part encouraged by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who financed some of these entities to buy up homes. And then it remained and it sort of fell back and was at a modest level. And in the last several years, toward the end of the pandemic and over the last couple of years, it's really mushroomed significantly. And I think that's for two reasons. One, from the Wall Street point of view, and I'm talking about REITs, particularly general partnerships, they had raised tremendous amounts of capital before the pandemic to invest in real estate. And suddenly in the pandemic, one wasn't going to invest in shopping centers or retail or in office buildings.
Oh.
So a lot of that got focused on either just buying normal rental properties, you know, standard apartment buildings, but also got focused on buying single-family homes because I saw single-family homes going up, becoming less affordable. And if they could buy, and their focus was in buying in less expensive neighborhoods and less expensive, more affordable parts of the country. And so they saw this as an opportunity to make long-term gains and to push up rents. And they did algorithms showing we could add rent charges for this. Unlike one landlords, they could basically create standardized ways of doing this. So they've seen this as a big opportunity, and the more inflation is heated up, the more they're now pitching this to their investors as this is a perfect hedge against inflation.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's been driving this.
It just sounds like a bad thing. In your very useful September piece for Housing Wire, co-written with Barry Zegas, you also point out, and you've just kind of hinted towards it, that these institutional purchases are highly concentrated in areas with minority families, with people of color. And so with this country's history of redlining and discriminatory government subsidies, we spoke with Richard Rothstein about this years ago, this has also huge, really, racial ramifications as well, yeah?
Yeah. So in fact, part of the way I approach this problem is I just written a book last year, Freedom to Discriminate, on how the realtors conspired to segregate housing and divide the country. And as I've been talking about that in different places, this issue has come up in those discussions in places I didn't expect, talking about this in Greensboro, North Carolina, and basically turned into a community meeting about gentrification in East Greensboro and out-of-town investors buying homes. So it's happening there. It's happening virtually everywhere. It's not only in minority areas. It's not necessarily deliberately targeted, but it's targeted buying homes on average like 26% below the statewide average. So that means a focus on startup homes, on modest homes,
right,
many of which have been in minority. So it's having an outsized impact. There's an excellent Federal Reserve Bank Minneapolis study mapping where these corporate landlords are buying, and you can see tremendous overlap with areas where minorities live or would normally buy.
Well, you also note, and you just tilted towards this, but it might need spelling out. With fewer families able to buy homes, those people stay renting.
Yes.
And so landlords can then push up rents as well. It's kind of a self-feeding sort of cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. So those people remain renters, and they're at the top end of the rental market. So it allows landlords to push up rents in general. And these corporate landlords are pace setting, and very explicitly they're deciding, well, the median income of our tenants is this, we can push to a higher percentage of disposable income. That's what's happening. And the impact of reducing the number of homes that families can buy, this is what's really key. There's a record low levels of how many homes are available for purchase because people are staying in their homes longer because they're affected by being able to find another place. And with that record low inventory, and this happened especially during the pandemic, there's a pressure to push up prices. If you remove a lot of the starter homes, the modest cost homes, families can't even bid on them because they've been swooped up in all cash, no inspection offers that no family can compete with. They're bidding against each other for a smaller and smaller share of homes. That's pushing up prices, and that's pushing up rents.
Well, and then also ownership means power. So it matters in terms of policy that the market, this market is now one where Wall Street is invested and is going to be trying to call the shots. Who owns the homes in a neighborhood has an effect on policy in that neighborhood. And it's just another element that this is affecting, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it also has an effect on neighborhood stability.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, single-family neighborhoods that have been large in ownership or significantly ownership, to remove the opportunities for ownership makes those into less stable neighborhoods. It's a long-term effect on home ownership in the country, and it's really asking, who do we want to own America? Who do we want to own our neighborhoods?
Well, there has been some critical and thoughtful media coverage. I can't list it all. I saw Alana Samuels in The Atlantic back in 2019. You know, there's been people illuminating this phenomenon and just saying, let's pay attention to this. But then I see this piece in the New York Times that's just so Timesian. Is Wall Street really to blame for the affordable housing crisis? You know, quote, who's to blame? An increasingly popular answer among Democrats and even some Republicans is Wall Street, close quote. So now it's not about discrimination. It's not even about policy. It's just kind of partisan political football. And then it becomes a caricature of an argument rather than engagement with that argument. Is private equity the true villain or a scapegoat? The piece says, not everyone is convinced that Wall Street's entry into the single-family rental market is uniformly bad. It says, and then I'm going to close on this, it says, quote, but unalloyed evil or not, institutional investors simply don't have the market power to be driving the affordable housing crisis, close quote. I just find that so belittling and just kind of silly, you know, the idea that there's a problem and people are pointing fingers and you want to point fingers at the powerful people, but that makes you emotional, so leave it to us cooler heads. You know, I just wonder how you react to coverage like that that says Wall Street's not to blame. They might be a scapegoat.
So I think this is an entirely false and wasteful use of time and of the New York Times. So the issue isn't who's to blame for anything. There are so many factors that affect home prices. The Federal Reserve having kept interest rates low, zoning regulations for large lot single family zoning. There's no limit to the number of causes one could try and explain this. The question is, what is the situation now? What's making it worse? Are federal taxpayers subsidizing that? So let me describe first a conversation we had with a leading economist who had worked for these hedge funds, who's sort of the key spokesperson on this issue. And her immediate response was, well, you're saying that hedge funds are solely to blame for what's happened to housing prices. And that's obviously false. We say, we're not saying that. Nobody's saying that, or at least nobody, you know, needs to say that at all. Rather, we're now in a situation where what was unaffordability of homeownership focused on a few metropolitan areas in terms of the median family income and median family price. 5 years ago, that was like 6 or 7 metropolitan areas in the country. That problem has now spread to like 90% of the metropolitan areas. We're seeing a sea change in the difficulty of buying homes in the country. Home prices nationally gone up by 40% with interest rates going up. They add 45% to the monthly payment, to the cost of buying the same home. You add those two together, and we're now in a situation, an overall affordability crisis that affects virtually everyone who doesn't own a home, even the children of those who do. And to put this in context, during the pandemic, household wealth, home equity, increased by $6 trillion in this country. A typical family in San Jose, their household wealth went up by $250,000. In Montana, by $50,000, wherever. Where does that money come from? How do you suddenly wind up owning so much more? The answer is that's an obligation of all the people who don't buy homes as to what it will cost them in monthly payments to buy homes or to pay more rent. So this is now a widespread problem. So that's our situation. We're at a time, and part of what's driven that is the sales inventory of single-family homes is very low, and it's just at historic low levels. People are staying in homes longer. It's harder to buy another home. Okay. So in that context, here you have one factor that's particularly affecting starter homes in a concentrated way in precisely the neighborhoods where families traditionally tried to buy their first home. There's been a dramatic reduction in first-time home buyers in general over the last year and in families that are 25 to 34 years old. So it's pushing the age at which people can afford to buy much longer. That's the context. And sure, these corporate landlords, they only own a small share in total of all the millions of homes in the country. That doesn't matter. What matters is the impact on the inventory available for sale in a given market at a given time. That's what drives prices. It doesn't matter if they only own 3% of all single institutional investors in Texas in 2021 bought 28% of the single family homes for sale. That was a broad definition of investment. And they're buying on average, as I said, 26% below the median sale price. Their concentration is precisely where people could otherwise buy homes. So the answer isn't who's to blame. The answer is this a problem? And in this situation, American families are facing, and when you step back and you realize that American taxpayers are subsidizing these purchases, that's really the key. The question isn't who's to blame. The question is, should we as taxpayers, all of us, be paying more so hedge funds and Wall Street investors can buy up the single-family homes that families would normally be able to buy? That's the question. Is that what we want our tax dollars to be being used for? Because that's what's happening.
Well, Democrat Representatives Ro Khanna, Katie Porter, and Mark Takano have now introduced the Stop Wall Street Landlords Act. What should we know about that, and are there other ways forward that you're thinking about?
The approach that Barry and I outlined and that, you know, we've been talking on the Hill about and with the White House is a very narrow, limited, focused approach to try and gain as broad support as we can, because we're up against, obviously, some of the strongest forces in the country, who these buyers are. And there are other laws being proposed, the one you mentioned and others, that go much further, that have 100% transfer taxes. I think all approaches can be good. The question is, what can be done that's realistic, that can't be challenged in the Supreme Court? So what we focused on is a simple, narrow change to the tax law so that if you're a homeowner, you have a limit on the amount of interest you can deduct on your home, $750,000 of debt. But we've proposed to say, put a similar limit on these major funds and say, if you own more than 100 single-family homes, you don't get an interest deduction. That'll reduce the rate of return. And here's the key. We're making this revenue neutral by saying an investor now owns such homes and they bought them. Fine. You can recoup the deduction you'll lose even when you sell that home to a first-time home buyer in the next 4 years. So it has a double power. It's reducing the incentive to buy these homes, and it's using that same tax subsidy to encourage investors to make those homes available to first-time buyers. That's really the key. So it's changing the nature of what American taxpayers are subsidizing, and that ought to be the question. Should we be subsidizing undermining home ownership in this country, especially at this time, or should we be supporting it?
All right, then I'm going to end on that hopeful note. We've been speaking with Gene Slater. You can find his and Barry Zegas' piece, Stop Subsidizing Wall Street Buying Up Homes, on housingwire.com. Gene Slater, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Sure. Thank you very much.
While people struggling with pandemic health impacts, stagnant wages and job losses were then hit with higher prices on many goods, elite news media reported with a kind of wonder, why can't we find baby formula? How does this supply chain work? That ingenuousness didn't help anyone learn what was behind the crisis or how to address it or to prevent it in future. Rakeen Mahboud is chief economist and managing director of policy and research at Groundwork Collaborative. We talked with her in February about supply chain breakdowns and particularly the role of workers.
It's not like prices are rising for no reason. Actually, the root causes here is a system that's really been in the works for the last half a century, right? 50 years of a supply chain, a series of policy decisions that have built a supply chain that was unable to handle shocks like the pandemic. And so when the pandemic hit, what we ended up seeing was massive shifts in demand, but also this extremely brittle system break down under those changes in demand. And so I'm happy to go into that, but eager to hear from you what you found interesting about the piece.
Well, let's talk about that brittleness, because I think, you know, when reporters think about news you can use, they're like, hey, prices are up. And so prices are up, that's bad. We're supposed to pick an enemy for that or a cause or a reason. And I don't know that that energy is directed in the right place. So if you could talk about what is it that made the supply chain fragile? What made it brittle in the first place?
Sure. So we've essentially spent 50 years handing our supply chain over to mega corporations. So these companies have built a system that works for them, right? It works for padding their own profits, jacking up their profits, all spurred on by Wall Street, who really demanded short-term profit increases over all else. And so when you think about what a supply chain is for, usually most people would think, oh, it's here to deliver goods and services. Well, that's actually not what our supply chain was built to do. Our supply chain was built to really maximize what companies could get out of this and the dividends that they can pay out to shareholders. And what that means is that they've essentially built a system that has no redundancy. It has no sort of flexibility for changes in an economy such as a pandemic or even something like a climate shock, right, which we're unfortunately likely to see more of over the coming years and decades. And so there is what we call sort of a just-in-time supply system, right? This is a supply system that is expected to deliver exactly the number of goods that are needed and at exactly the moment that they're needed. But with something like a pandemic, all of those predictions about what goods will be needed when go out the window, and that's when you end up with supply shortages. That's what you end up with bottlenecks. The consolidation piece of this is also really important. We have three ocean shipping alliances that carry 80% of the world's cargo. So there, if one of them goes down, that you can see how that sort of massively disrupts our global supply chain, but you can also see how that might jack up prices.
So where do workers fit in there? What is the role of the employees that are obviously a piece of this? What does labor policy, what does that do?
Yeah, I'm really, really glad you asked that, because I think when people think of the supply chain, they have this sort of vague images of cranes and maybe a big ship, right? But those big yeah. ships and those cranes are operated by people. And I think the effect on workers is made most clear through the example of trucking. About 80% of port truckers are misclassified as independent contractors. That means that they don't get good wages, they don't have predictable hours, they don't get benefits. Some of them can't even use the bathroom at the ports because they're not technically considered employees. And that erosion of labor, we see that throughout, right? We see that on these giant ships that are waiting offshore to unload their goods. There are people on those ships who are not being paid very well. In fact, a lot of these ships fly with what's called flags of convenience, which are the flags of countries that have really, really low labor standards, so they don't have to adhere to higher standards on the ship. So across their supply chains, we basically have incredible reliance on precarious labor. And what that means is that people are being harmed. And part of the reason we've ended up in this position of incredible reliance on precarious labor is that companies have tried to profit maximize, right? They don't want to pay those benefits. They don't want to pay good wages. They want to make sure that they can squeeze as much out of a worker as they can with paying them as little as possible. So I'm really glad you asked that question, because bad labor practices and our reliance on precarious labor is a real liability in our supply chain as a whole.
I have to say, the story that we get, and I'm not being facetious, the story that we get from the media about capitalism is, you know, that it takes advantage of certain situations, but not that it's cruel, you know, not that when people are sick, you jack up the prices of medicine. Like, I feel like in most people's brains, that's what a horrible person does. You know, that's not what a system does. And yet, that is incentivized by certain systems in this country. I'm not sure that people really grok that, but it's true.
Yeah. You know, I have a good example for that, which is in their Q4 2021 earnings call, Johnson & Johnson, which is a pretty familiar brand, I think, to many people, announced that they had raised prices on their consumer health products and about 29 of their prescription drugs last year. And on that earnings call, the CEO told investors that a strong underlying demand for medical care and all there is to do to, quote, address suffering and death caused by different diseases is part of their company's, quote, optimism and opportunity for its future performance. I mean, this is out in the public, right? This is not said behind a closed door. They're literally celebrating the fact that there's a long way to go before a lot of people are healthy again and how that helps them raise money. Long story short, these mega retailers are just using inflation as a cover to raise prices and turn record profits, all in the midst of an unprecedented health crisis. And that's not morally acceptable, but I think importantly, it's also really, really not good for our economy. Because when you have this much inequality, that is not what makes a healthy economy. A healthy economy is one where workers and consumers and small businesses and smaller players in the market can really have a fighting chance. And that's just not the system we're living in right now.
That was Rakeen Mahboud of Groundwork Collaborative speaking with Counterspin in February of this year. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Quite an afternoon today. We got our first snow here in Kansas for the year 2022, I guess. Well, the winter is coming.
Log Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think.
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Coming up here at the top of the hour, John Grant. That's right, John Grant live. And you could call in area code 646-716-8652. We can get you on the air, maybe, with John Grant. We're going to be talking about the elections today, the aftermath of the midterm elections. And, you know, they're not all over yet.
Until some fat lady at the courthouse says it's The count is over. We'll be talking about that. Plus, Dave Lindorf, head honcho at thiscan'tbehappening.net, has a recent article, Let's Hear It for Justice Sam Alito. It's posted at the top of the scroll at thiscan'tbehappening.net. We'll be checking out that. I'm going to discuss that article with John Grant, whatever pops up in the New York Times. A good, interesting article on Burlington, Vermont, having its big city problems. In Burlington, Vermont, I mean.
We'll be right back.
corrupt, something like that. Great jazz from Henry Mancini. Coming up at the top of the hour, John Grant will have him in. And if you guys like to visit with him, we will. The weather, oh my goodness, the weather out here is amazing. It's, I think we're in a downward plunge. Weather forecast, zero by Friday or Saturday morning. That is zero. Do you believe that? 0 degrees. It's supposed to be like 19 low tonight. And we had here in northeast Kansas had snow showers. That's the common word. Snow showers and an accumulation of maybe half an inch here in North Jefferson County. Not enough to shut the schools down, but slick enough to wreck your car. The very interesting early deep winter. Let's see if we can get John on here after this. Last, Sort of Blue by Henry Mancini. Well, listeners, I think we lucked out once again here. We've got the Pennsylvania connection here. I think we got John Gray on the phone.
I'm here.
Dave Lindorf, listeners, he's part of the This Can't Be Happening, sort of the founding godfather of the dance, right? This Can't Be Happening, thiscan'tbehappening.net. He's got an article. I promised him I'd tell him, and it is an interesting article. It just popped up here a day and a half ago. It says, "Let's hear it for Justice Sam Alito, America's rogue Ayatollah."
Good way to go. Thanks to Alito, God bless the SOB. God bless him. He just pissed off everybody. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't just him. I mean, we have the happy mother, career mother on the Supreme Court, and we've got good old grumpy Clarence Thomas.
Oh, really?
That's a real gallery of characters now that are
absolutely
outlawing a woman's right to abortion and control her own body. I mean, talk about anti-libertarian.
Right.
The article he wrote, it goes into some the wonderful invective. He put listeners, Lindorf puts a lot of poison in his article on this, and you really want to check it out. It's a bit snarky, just ruthlessly hardcore on.
Ironically,
same note that you pointed out. I mean, it brought in massive numbers of people, young adults who were normally not interested, women and men. I mean, it just really just, this midterm thing really turned into it blew up in their faces, don't you think?
I think it literally blew up in their faces. Yeah, absolutely. They were, my favorite was Jesse Waters, the number one clown on Fox News, who's become quite popular there, I guess. He was saying on the Five, I think it was, he was blustering that before the election that he expected, 15 or something like 15 senators, they were going to take the Senate by 15 and or some ridiculous number, and then there we go. They were going to sweep the House with like 35 seats or something, and then he said, just half joking, I think, he said, and if that's not the case, it's voter suppression. And actually, ex-Republican Congressman Ford, a light-skinned black gentleman, called him on it and said, hey, whoa, that's bullshit. You can't do that. And so they were expecting this super-duper red wave, a tsunami. MSNBC played about 40 examples of it. The red wave is coming. Tsunami is coming. Everyone got worse and worse and more dramatic and hyperbole. It's a tsunami, like it's a massive tsunami, And alas, they were full of shit as usual.
Sort of ran on the rocks of reality. That's one thing about democracy that they fail to understand, or they damn sure don't want to understand, because they it conflicts with their interests financially, religiously,
exactly,
in every way. I mean, it really does. I mean,
their raw ambitions for simple power. That's all they want. They don't give a goddamn what they're doing with it. They just want it.
Well, the other side says the same thing about the Democrats. They do.
Obviously, the other side is wrong and we're right.
They're saying this is something, you know, the Democrats just want to wipe us out type shit. You know, it's like genocide. It's crazy talk on the other side. I mean,
right? Of course, it's crazy. They're right. They say that Democrats want power. Of course, the Democrats want power. You morons. You know, that's what their fucking political elections are about. You morons. You know, of course they want power. But the point is, they're more honest about it. You know, that's the only difference. It's a pure and simple difference. These days, 2022, the Democrats are much, much more honest about how they want power and how they'll get it, rather than the Republicans who have decided that, you know, I mean, they're actually taking Malcolm X, you know, by any means necessary, you know. They're becoming radical on the right, like Malcolm X been on the left, you know, and suddenly, you know, they'll do anything to get power. And, of course, I think the American people, even Republicans who voted for Trump in Kansas and places, they decided, wait a minute, you know, look, this is getting out of hand. We do not want this craziness in this country. So they held their noses and they voted, you know, maybe a different way than they told pollsters or something. It's like, you know, when people get in the voting booth, they get more serious. You know, they think, well, holy shit, you know. These guys are so bad, they're so power-oriented, you know, they could come and get me eventually, you know, and I think people are aware of that stuff, you know. But,
well, my neighbor...
So it was good, yeah.
My neighbor south of me, about 22 and a half miles, right across the river, Kaw River, which runs east and west at the bottom of northeast. Right across that river on the south end of the county line, he's not in the county, but he just got elected attorney general. And he is the reddest of the red, the craziest of the crazies of Trump people. He will be in January the Kansas attorney general. And he is one white cracker. I mean, he really is.
Wow.
I mean, his name is Kris Kobach. And
I know that name. He's haunted
he
you before.
Formerly,
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, he was Secretary of State. He never really bothered me. I mean, I think he knows. I mean, it's not worth it. It's not. I mean, you know, he had his own. He got to start with his own radio show. He got a law degree, East Coast, of course. If my memory serves right, East Coast, Ivy League. They all these smart reactions like Mike Pompeo, Sam Brownback. Well, Brownback was educated here, but Pompeo, all these reactionaries, really bad reactionaries. Leave here, go to your place on the East Coast, the Ivy League.
Well, that's because the wisdom is all ensconced here in the Northeast, you know.
Right.
And you guys come and you guys use the wisdom from the Northeast to twist things around and whack your ass out. Sorry. I love Kansas.
Hard.
You know, it's just, it's hard. You know?
Well, 50 years ago, I liked Pennsylvania. So, I mean, I went to a pretty cool bar there and State College.
Oh,
you know,
there's a couple
in the
here, yeah.
In the middle of nowhere, you know. So, I mean, all these crazies. And this guy, Kris Kobach, he was one of the guys, Secretary of State. He sold investigative reporter, Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. Did a great
An
interview.
No of him, yeah.
Yeah, he ambushed Kobach. In Kansas, excuse me, it's a very, very good video for Kansas to watch. He was selling this thing called CrossCheck. It's a software program to all the Republican attorney generals that wanted to run to wipe out the voter rolls. I mean, he taught what happened in Georgia you know, in 2016 and 2020. He taught. He sold the software to the people that purged voters. Computer spreadsheet. Yeah, called CrossCheck, and it purged hundreds of thousands of voters across the country. Chris Kobach, he developed that and did it, and he defends city councils that declare basically no brown people in the town, or cops can see a brown guy or see a Mexican or Latino, stop him and ask him for their state ID, He defends cases like that.
Yeah.
Oh,
he's a guy. He's now once again Secretary of State.
He's now Attorney General.
Attorney General, I'm sorry. Okay.
He was Secretary of State when he did all that shit, okay?
Right.
That was years ago, a few years ago. Now he got ran out of office and he ran for governor, lost. Ran for Senate,
right.
Lost. Then he ran for Attorney General and won. So now he's the chief law enforcement officer in the state of Kansas. And one of the things he campaigned on was he's going to set up a special office, a unit, he calls it a unit, that will do nothing but file lawsuits against Joe Biden. That's what he ran on.
Lawsuits.
So what is he going to do? And many people, I don't know, in Pennsylvania, I'm sure it goes on. What you do when you're an attorney, when you're getting a state like that, you got a budget or maybe no budget, and you just credit card, you just state of Pennsylvania credit card, state of Kansas credit card, and you just go and hire your buddies at law firms. When you're attorney general, you hire buddies in law firms, and it says here, run the bill up, file a lawsuit against Biden. Abortion clinics, he's gonna go crazy. Chris Kobach, he was on the White House steps looking for a job from Trump, our favorite, their favorite, orange Jesus. He was there. Remember when Steve Bannon and the New York Times, got in trouble over that wall, that scam about left?
Oh right,
the wall.
Well, wall scam. He had,
He had two other guys. One guy who has no arms and legs. My read, he's a vet.
Oh right, I remember that one too. It was some veteran
He pled guilty. We took money, but not Steve Bannon. Well, guess who? There's a photograph in your New York Times that I have a digital copy of. Chris Kobach.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Former Secretary of State of Kansas, future Attorney General of Kansas, standing at that wall, supporting, build the wall. With Steve Bannon.
Yeah, I think Bannon raised millions of dollars, and I think he did 10 feet of wall or something, like that.
Yeah. Well, more importantly, he took a million.
That was the whole purpose of it. Exploitation.
Yeah, right.
Exploit the politics that you're, inflaming,
The Orange Jesus pardoned him for that, but then
I remember.
These people.
He pardoned Michael Flynn, my favorite fascist. He pardoned him.
Right.
I think Mastriano in Pennsylvania, Mastriano, I'm convinced, is going to join the Michael Flynn militia, or whatever we want to call it, drummed out kind of drummed out officers, almost like the back in France when Algeria and Indochina became an issue, and there are all these angry officers that felt betrayed. They even did a coup in France, I believe, back in those days.
there's a famous novel by, was it Lacargue or whatever his name is, the Frenchman, has two novels, one about, you know, Indochina and one about Algeria. But the second one is about this, a fictional account of this, you know, drummed out officers, angry coup sort of thing, attempt. And the introduction to the novel, recent publication of it, is by Stanley McChrystal. He certainly understands this kind of movement. And his chief of intelligence, of course, was Michael Flynn, who is now our chief, you know, drummed out sort of, you know, officer, angry officer, upset at the impurities of America, militarism, you know, because I think, in fact, here, there's a large one-page editorial from the editorial board of the New York Times in Sunday's paper in the editorial section called Extremists in Uniform Put the Nation at Risk. And it's all about, you know, white supremacist groups and three percenters and all that overlapping in the military and the police and how this is a, you know, a real problem for America, you know. As I emailed my police chief and his number two guy, I said, the problem I have with this post-January 6th kind of issue with the right-wing militias and whatnot is, you know, I don't know whose side you guys are going to be on when the Civil War comes. I actually told them that in an email, you know, and I think it's true because, you know, there's so many secretive connections here, you know, and the New York Times sees it as a major problem, this overlap.
Well, it is. It is.
Yeah, and of course, then now we have also in the editorial page a story on the big lie has been exported to Brazil. So the Times, this Natalia Viana in an op-ed, suggests that Biden and Lula, the new president of Brazil who beat Bolsonaro, that they get together and they figure it out in both their cultures, the U.S. and in Brazilian culture, you know, how to, you know, push these people down, how to crush this movement and you know, move on. So we'll see. You know, it's interesting stuff going on because Lula won in Brazil a major, major win because Latin America is, again, once again going left. You know, like Colombia has a leftist president. Honduras has a leftist president. You know, and these aren't like nasty ones that the U.S. hates, like Ortega and Maduro in Venezuela. These are, you know, acceptable, you know, leaders. And there's like five others, like Chile now has a leftist president, and Chile and Colombia has a leftist president. You know, you got to be kidding. And so Mexico has a leftist president. Of course, Mexico also has the most ruthless gangs in the world. And they're going nose to nose with the government, even the leftist government. So, you know, there are real problems in the world. But this move to the left in Latin America, I think, is going to affect us here. It's a major, epical shift that is going to pressure the United States. Yeah, I'm on the record here. You know, because I think as the world. Develops competitions with China, Russia, and all these markets, the United States is going to pull back to the Western Hemisphere. And that means you link up with South America. You know, these are the people that, you know, Henry Kissinger said were passed over by the arc of history. You know, the people below the equator were all a bunch of, you know, dark people and, behind the eight ball with we Westerners in America and all that. You know, the arc of history has passed them by. Well, I think the new arc of history may actually pick them up. And, you know, we may have a new shift here that makes the right wing in America much, much harder to sustain its electoral victories because they have to cheat. They made it clear they have to cheat in order to win. You know, it's very complicated, obviously, and there's no great absolute wins. Everything is shifting at all times, you know. I know.
Well, the...
They're
yelling about... Yeah, they're calling everybody cheaters, you know. In Philadelphia, mm-hmm. no less, they're claiming that...
Right.
Ballot boxes, I mean, the ballot boxes are being stuffed, and they gave that word.
Yeah.
They developed a language, you know, mules.
Obviously. Everybody in Philadelphia is a crook. There's no question about it. Yeah. You know, the idea of urban living, you know, you pack people on top of each other. You know, people in rural areas, you know, the red states can't understand what it's like to live on top of each other. This is one of my themes.
No,
you know, it's like, you know, it's difficult to live with a neighbor who's not a half a mile or 2 miles away, you know, and this guy lives right next door.
We're not forced to socialize. We can remain like hermits or recluses. You know, we don't even have to associate with, except once a week or so to go get a bottle of food. You know,
right, you meet them at the liquor store, you know, or the
liquor store, and the grocery store. Well, and the grocery store. If we're lucky enough to have a grocery store,
right.
We may not have a grocery store for very long. We always worried about that. You know, the New York Times. I'm going to go with you on this. The New York
mm-hmm.
Times today, the digital mm-hmm. subscription, which I have
right
now,
okay, good,
had an article saying, very interesting article about Colombia, the country, listeners,
mm-hmm.
in South America. Colombia's mm-hmm. new president, left-leaning president, is saying something pretty cool and radical. He's saying,
mm-hmm.
we're going to exploit our oil reserves in order to quit using our oil reserves.
That's cool. I like that.
It's in the Times. I was like, that's very interesting. I wonder how we can fit that in the show today, but it's something very
interesting. Well, also,
you
got Colombia. I think it's a woman president in Colombia, a leftist woman president. And then, you got Venezuela. Everybody's fleeing with the Dorian Gap, you know, all this news stories about coming to the border in America. And, of course, Biden has been talking with the Maduro government, Maduro government in Venezuela about, you know, cooking up a connection for oil. You know, I mean, this is what I'm saying about the hemisphere sort of sticking together when Saudi Arabia goes south and tells us to go fuck ourselves, you know. So, hey, let's go talk to Maduro and get over this crap that we've been going through for 20 years. You know, Hugo Chavez, he fucked up a little bit. We can accept that. And the right wing are a bunch of clowns down there. So, you know, both of those criticisms do have some weight. And let's work it out for the Venezuelan people so they don't flee up the United States. Everything smart should suggest to us, yeah, we need to sit down with Maduro and Venezuela and figure this stupid mess out. Of course, it's hard to do when you're polarized, in such a clown fashion as the United States is now. It can't do anything that's novel. It has to, you know, do everything that you did in the past, including... oppressing black people and all the other things from the wonderful past.
I want to ask you a question. Can you remember what did Obama do
mm-hmm.
to get the embargo practically lifted on Cuba? Because some of the prettiest girls I know on Facebook, they went to Cuba. They went to Cuba. I mean, they traveled there like tourists, you know?
Sure.
I mean, they didn't have any problems.
Well, he did open it
under
up.
Obama opened it.
Yeah.
I mean, how did he do that? Because Biden could – how did he do it? Biden needs to do that.
Well, he did it. He did it because the world or the United States had not
encountered
the phenomenon of Donald Trump.
I know
I know why Obama did it, but I'm wondering, how did he do it? Can you remember? Because I can't remember how he – did he have a Congress that let him do it? Was it the House of Representatives? Or why is it Joe?
That's a good question. Was it executive action?
Right.
It may have been just all executive action.
I don't know.
And the point is the timing was right. The timing was right. And then, of course, because the timing was right then, and they opened it up to Cuba, and you think of, you know, Miami being the capital of right-wing Latin America, you know, the backlash happened, and Trump came in, and he put the huge kibosh on it. He crushed it.
Mm-hmm.
He put his boot down on it. And, of course, because Trumpism made such a bizarre splash in American history and politics, there's still a resonating afterglow of it, if you will, that Biden, you know, can't go back and say, okay, we're going to reopen Cuba. It just, Trumpism moved the bar back to the right, and it's taken a while.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think, you know, this is what I call about incrementalism. You know, two steps forward, one step back, and then you incrementally work your way back to where you were, you know. And this is how politics works in America, anywhere probably. And, you know, they say democracy is, the best government of lousy governments in the world, you know. So anyway, you know, eventually, if this, you know, midterm, this amazing midterm that was such a surprise for Democrats' success, you know, if that's continued, if the American people and if the left can get its head out of its ass, you know, then the left can start, you know, this incremental and pushing it. And, you know, eventually another administration, you know, could be very serious and then lift the embargo again. But, you know, it takes a bit. There's got to be new leadership in places like the House. I think, Nancy Pelosi's done a fantastic job, but I think she has probably run her course. They're now talking about my favorite guy in the House, Hakeem Jeffries. I don't know where exactly. Oh, he's a light-skinned black fella, but he is tough as nails. It doesn't matter what race he is. He's beyond race. And he is just sharp as a tack, quiet, tough, and they're talking about him. I think he would be a perfect speaker. Minority, if they win by two seats, maybe, the Republicans, you put Hakeem Jeffries in there, and, they can start, starting fresh, getting tough, and we'll see what happens in 2024.
Not much of a minority. It's only like 10. Oh,
right.
And by the way, I have news for you and listeners. Not all, matter of fact, many people I don't like, but Ben Shapiro, of all people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I notice about this guy, the faster he talks, the more lies are coming out of his mouth. I mean, he said that it was obviously not a waste. He was not happy. He was not happy, but he said basically, you know, obviously this is not a waste. And he was scolding his fellow Republican conservative people.
Right.
And millions of young people watch this guy, young people.
Ben Shapiro, he's a Republican, right?
He's a commentator. He's sort of like, I would call him, fancies himself a Paul Harvey of the right, the new Paul Harvey.
Maybe a
lawyer,
new
Rush Limbaugh.
I don't even
know if he's a goddamn lawyer. He may have dropped out for clicks, you know, on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, he may have dropped out. But the guy is a figurehead and a big one.
Right.
Among young people, maybe 30, 35.
Oh, I'm thinking of somebody else. My guy's in 70.
At most. No, this guy's very young. And he put it up first. And it caused a ripple among them, pardon the talk about red wave, but it caused a ripple among the ecosphere of right-wing pundits. And these pundits are, you know, they're very powerful on the clickables. And I was been watching them to react. The reaction that it was obviously not a wave. McCarthy predicted 60 seats before all 60. You got it. Right. And there's all these notable defeats with the governors around the country. And the Michigan sweep, Michigan has went blue, you know, even in the state legislature. I mean, this is something they can't deny. And there's this people like Rick Wilson and Tara Detmeyer, I think is her name, on the Lincoln Project. And listeners, I encourage you to check out the Lincoln Project.
I like Rick Wilson.
It comes from they're very interesting. Yeah, it's funny too to watch. She called him Tara. She got him to her co-host to crack up because she called it a tinkle. It's a red tinkle.
It's red tinkle. Really? Yeah, exactly. A tinkle.
Not trickle. Not trickle.
It's not a trickle. Trickle. It's a tinkle.
It's a tinkle.
It's like somebody tinkling in the toilet. You can hear them like tinkle.
It's like, well, I think who's tinkling has a mushroom dick, tinkle. According to his, what's your opinion? Predict, on the record, John Grant, what is he going to say tonight from Mar-a-Lago?
So Don is speaking tonight from Mar-a-Lago?
Donald Trump is making a national.
Okay,
he's
going to announce. He's got the network. He's going to announce, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's what they say. He said it, but I mean, other people. Part of the Tinkle, the Tinkle crew, you know, the ones that work him up.
Right.
You know, they're saying no. Wait till after Georgia. After this, what do you call it, the runoff?
Oh, yeah.
Wait till it takes
Georgia, the Georgia vote is on my wife's December 6th, the day before Pearl Harbor, is the day for the Georgia runoff.
Big deal.
Big deal.
Yeah.
And in fact, they had, Lawrence O'Donnell had, what is his name, Senator Peters, from Michigan, I believe he is, a very quiet, sort of serious fellow who has been assigned the job of Senate campaign finance raising and all that kind of stuff. As Lawrence O'Donnell, who used to work in the Senate as an aide, said, it is the least preferable job in the Senate. Everybody hates doing this job. In other words, raising money for everybody. And this guy, apparently Senator Peters from Michigan, has done, according to Lawrence O'Donnell, who understands the Senate, the most amazing job this election cycle of getting Democrats elected. I mean, this guy was a killer. And he was talking about, what are you going to do in Georgia? Well, we're going to keep doing in Georgia what we did to, you know, get Nevada and to hold on to Arizona and all this kind of stuff. And, of course, you think of poor Herschel Walker, ex-football player, you know. And every time you see him now, he's got sweating bullets and all this kind of stuff. The last thing poor Herschel wants is to have to keep campaigning, you know, because it must be so embarrassing for him, everybody accusing him of being stupid and all this kind of stuff. Now, of course, in Georgia, the argument that he is critical for the Republicans owning the Senate is now a completely moot issue. Whether, you know, if Herschel Walker wins in Georgia, the Democrats still own the Senate. You know, they gained that one vote from Pennsylvania, from our man.
Right.
Yeah, you know, John Fetterman. And so
that's right.
How many of those, you know, hypothetical, but I think quite a lot, of essentially, you know, hardcore Republican Georgians, you know, frankly, a bit racist and all this, who having to hold their nose and, you know, oh, God, I can't believe I'm voting for this goddamn football player. But, but I got to vote. Well, how many of those people are going to come out and vote for Herschel now? They're going to say, well, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, the Democrats own the place. They're going to own it whether I go out and vote for this slob or not. And I think a lot of them are going to stay home. And I think the Democrats are going to be fired up. One, they got a candidate that's light years better as a senator, you know, to participate in the world's greatest deliberative body, they call it. You know,
right.
This guy, you know, Warner is good. Not Warner. What am I saying?
Warnock.
Warnock. Sorry. Excuse me. But anyway, I think December 9, 6 is going to be a real amazing thing. I have friends in Atlanta who are into politics. I even feel like driving down for the election on the 6th. You know.
Take your sweetheart with you.
I could. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but, make it a holiday.
So I think, you know, Atlanta in Georgia has become, you know, the ground zero in politics these days.
Uh-huh.
I mean, certainly was ground zero in 2020 with those, you know, January 6th was, you know, the insurrection trumped, I think, pun intended, trumped, you know, the really, really big news about those two runoffs in Georgia that gave the Senate to the Democrats. You know, we
right.
lost the earth-shattering essence of that day because the other side tried to take over Congress, you know. So, you know, politics is pretty amazing these days. And Ezra Klein, I don't know if you know who Ezra Klein is, but he's a New York Times featured writer here. Where the hell is his piece here? Anyway, he's got a piece that suggests that what does he call it? I'm gonna find this thing. It's hard, but you know the elections now are you know, we're polarized, but at the same time we're polarized on a local, you know, in ways that are very interesting because he says there's also a moment of parity. We're so close. Every election's around 50%. It's so, so close,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
But then just that little sliver of difference can be a radical difference in the government, you know, and it's a very precarious time. And, hey, we're in the middle of it. And, you know, like what the Chinese say, it's a gift and a curse to live in interesting times. Well, we're in them.
Well, excuse me, in Kansas, I mean, we have this – it's not all bad news here. They reelected
right.
The governor, the woman governor.
Absolutely.
Laura
Kelly. Laura, what's her name?
And
Laura?
Laura Kelly,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's and they and I think that all those I think only maybe one Democrat was knocked out of office.
Right.
I mean, on the state legislature, so they're a very tiny minority. I mean, it's like they're like a third of the House and the Senate. And to hold on to that. Another encouraging note, a former wrestler, lesbian, Native American, is still our member.
Oh, she won
in
again?
The Congress. She won again. She won re-election.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was
fantastic.
And they gerrymandered her. The state legislature gerrymandered, did everything they could to, you know, they made her district like You know, they knocked out half of the people that voted for her and put in who they thought would vote against her, and they didn't. They did not. So I mean, it's sort of very interesting how this change, this transformation of America is
in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, a couple things: the state House of Representatives has been consistently Republican for many years now, you know,
right,
and they've turned against Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. There's this real, you know, red county, blue county kind of struggle, and, you know, Philadelphia, especially North Philadelphia, the poor, you know, gets the short end of the stick always at time, well, thanks to the Republicans in Harrisburg. However, they're still sorting it out. But there is a possibility that the Democrats may have, in the end, you know, flipped and taken the House of Representatives in Harrisburg, a state House of Representatives, which is really big news here. And a guy I know, a friend of mine, who I've known as a high school activist back in the 80s, and he's, been a real operator. He's been working for Krasner and Krasner's office, the DA, the progressive DA in Pennsylvania, Philly. He just won in the state house. So a friend of mine is now a state rep in Harris.
Oh, you got
you know, a young man. He's in his probably early 30s. And, you know, as I told him, I was at a birthday party the other day. I said, hey, man, you know, 15, 20 years from now, Speaker of the House, Ben Waxman. I can see it now. He goes, oh, my God.
You're all right. I may not want to work that hard.
Right. Yeah.
So
but, you know, good things are happening.
Who is this guy that you think is going to replace Nancy? Who is this guy again? What's his name?
Oh, Hakeem Jeffries. He's where the hell is he? I got so many pieces of paper here.
That's okay.
Where's Hakeem? Let me find. I got him here. Here he is, Hakeem. Okay, the Hakeem story. Well, he's where's he from? He's a congressman.
State.
Hakeem, Hakeem Jeffries, and he's the one in the article here that they're suggesting could take over the Speaker of the House. Now, I've thought for some time, every time I see this guy, I say, whoa, there's something just so damn solid about him. And, you know, he's black. But, you know, he's not race is not an issue with him. That's what's amazing. You know, some people transcend race. And I think that's what we got to do on the left. We got to transcend these identity politics. And, you know, everybody, you know, raise all boats kind of thing, you know. And
I got him. He's from Brooklyn. He represents the New York 8th district.
Okay,
since 2013, and it covers parts of the eastern Brooklyn and southwestern Queens in New York City. Hakeem Jeffries.
He's a man.
Very
we'll see. He's not a nasty guy in pursuit of power. You know, it's almost like he would be gracious. You know, whenever Nancy might be ready to give it up. You know, Nancy Pelosi. I don't know. I just think. And then there's people that are. You know, the guy Paul Ryan. I think it's Paul Ryan, the guy who lost the Senate to J.D. Vance in Ohio, you know. That's very unfortunate because Tim Ryan was is really a good politician from Ohio, you know, with Sherrod Brown, Sherrod Brown also in Ohio.
Yeah, what could possibly this guy, J.D. Vance, what could he possibly... What do you think he's going to be doing? in his official capacity.
Oh, he's going to be covering his sorry ass. That's what he's. You know, here's this guy. He wrote this memoir about Maw-Maw, his redneck mother, grandmother, or whatever that was.
And
then he turned out to go and work for Goldman Sachs. You know, it's like wait a minute. Here, you're like the people. You're about the people and Maw-Maw and all your family stuff, and then you go off and go to Yale or wherever the hell you went, learn finance and work for Goldman Sachs so you can fleece the people and make money. What the hell's going on with you, pal? And well, he won, but
and
what are you gonna
do? And became a heartthrob. A heartthrob to all the people on Wall Street, the yuppie wannabes. I mean, it's to pull yourself up by your bootstraps
right.
And go to Harvard and Yale.
Go to Harvard and then Goldman Sachs and, the world's richest are at your feet, And it's like, hey.
I mean, the Wall
Street
Journal.
My dad, the capitalist, bigoted capitalist, would say he always liked he'd always say, the one he really liked was the head of GE, Welch, Jack Welch, ruthless son of a bitch.
Uh-huh.
And he's a bright guy. It's all these guys are bright guys, Yeah, he's a bright guy. They're all bright guys. And you know what makes a bright guy? The ability to get your money out of your wallet into his wallet. That's what makes a bright guy. as Willie Sutton he robbed banks because that's where the money was, Well, finance now has worked out because they realize where the money is in the people's pockets. So how do we fucking get that out of the people's pockets into our pockets, That's what a bright guy like J.T. Vance does. He learned that in Yale or Harvard, wherever the hell he went.
Yeah. Why don't you write a book about your white trash relatives? Your white trash relatives. Why don't you write a book
I'm working on a memoir right now. I'm sort of working. I've got some efforts done. It's all about being thrown. Oh, good. I was thrown as a 10-year-old. I was dropped into redneck South Dade County,
Just email. What is it? What are we going to call him? The Honorable Representative J.D. Vance. With your pitch, with your novel pitch, and say, who's your agent? And ask him, who's your agent, I think, because that's all he did, and that's why I think that's all true.
Well,
he was endorsed.
Memoir writing
endorsed
is an art,
by,
and he had it down. He had it down,
I haven't read it. I think I read excerpts on the Kindle.
I saw the movie where Glenn Close played Maw-Maw.
I have not done that. I have
his
not
grandma Maw-Maw.
God.
I haven't read the book. I have a copy of it, but I haven't read it.
I wonder what really sold. Is he Hemingway? Is he a literary genius?
I don't know.
Style? I think it's. I can't believe it. I'll have to.
Well, I think
check
he actually.
Myself,
he pulled it off. He wrote it. Acceptable memoir. That couched things in his way, and it was very successful. Of course, I'm absolutely envious and jealous of his success as a memoir writer. But I would not have voted for him.
Oh, God, I would never vote for him. I mean, but it's because what comes out of his mouth? He's crazy anti-abortion. At least he says he is. And he's so far up Trump's colon that you'd need a colonoscopy to find him. It's just nonstop
with this guy.
He's exactly like McCarthy and all these people that trashed Trump. They all trashed him in horrible ways. J.D. Vance said terrible things about Trump. And then, of course, turned around and absolutely abjectly kissed his ass. And, in fact, Tim Ryan, the guy who ran against him in Ohio, on the debate stage accused him, you know, of kissing, you know, J.D. Vance is standing over there like the, you know, he ate the canary, you know, or the canary there, whatever, you know, the cat that ate the canary. And he said, yeah, you know, he explains all this. And then you just went and you kept kissing his ass. And now you're kissing his ass. This is on the debate stage. You know, and poor J.D. Vance standing there like, oh, my God, yes, this is all true. Yeah.
Ohioans,
yeah, voted him in.
Well, how big?
So it's going to be. It's going to be interesting. The future is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think John. I don't think John. I don't think J.D. is John Steinbeck, the greats of wrath. I'll have to check out Hillbilly Elegy and
Hillbilly Elegy. I'll take a hint from him in my memoir. I'll have Redneck in the Redneck Elegy. How about that? A teenage redneck. How about that? I was a
teenage
redneck.
I don't know if I'd go for that, but I mean, we'll talk.
No, I don't.
You know, we'll have to come up with something catchier than Teenage Redneck versus Hillbilly Elegy. I mean, it's.
Yeah, right.
Well, hey, let's speak. All right, we got 7 minutes. Movies.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I guess Hillbilly Elegy is still on Netflix. I guess I don't know if I.
Yeah,
I
would not recommend it though. I would not recommend it. You know.
I mean, I have
especially since the movie was made, he has turned out to be such an asshole. So I would not recommend it. You know, when the movie was made, he was not. You know, he was still a interesting memoir author until he became a dishonest, you know, full of crap Senate candidate, you know. And that was a different animal then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so what have you been watching?
Movies. Let's see. God, I know, I'm trying to remember what I watched. Can't think right now. I should make a list of movies I've seen. How about you? You see any good movies?
I haven't seen any new ones, but I was watching one, really horrible one called The Last Rampage or something. I'll have to look up.
Oh, my Lord.
It was a docudrama, you might call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of who stars it. It's about these two convicts that made an escape out of a Texas prison, and he used one of the convicts used his three sons to get to escape. And then it's really, I mean, it's like a religious fundamentalism is involved in it, corporal punishment, beat your kids, you know, that whole thing. And then his sons all end up doing life sentences, and he ends up in the desert escaping. They helped him escape from prison, and he ends up, they killed like mass slaughter. These boys watched their dad kill all these people. I mean, it's like ambushing people, steal their cars, and then just killing them rather than letting them go. And on their getaway, and he ends up dying 50 yards from a watering hole in the desert, Mexican desert.
Wow.
Escape the father does.
That sounds kind of gloomy there. Yeah.
Right, and there were actually four sons, and one of the sons who did military duty. He was killed driving through the barricades, the sheriff's barricades to stop him. And the father escapes. The three surviving sons end up to this day, doing life sentences in Texas prison.
Mm-hmm.
And their father dies of dehydration 50 yards from a watering hole in the Mexican desert, escaping.
That sounds really, really cheerful there.
Well, you're the one that recommended the counselor.
Yeah, Luann has commented on my taste in movies that are so dark and depressing. It's like,
look
at the books
I thought I'd
my God, I'm so depressing.
You know? But I'm one-upping you, you know, because you the captain.
Well, I got one
see,
for
you're,
you.
You're,
I just remembered.
No, wait. Let's just recap.
Okay,
let's
go
just
ahead.
Recap
go ahead
you
go.
Got one. Okay. Let's see. I watched The Counselor, and I thought, that is depressing, but it's a bunch of rich people killing each other off. You know, that's how I looked at it.
I guess, what I liked about it was the poor guy, how you make decisions
in
life.
The poor guy's a warrior.
Well, you make decisions because you're riding around a Bentley. You think you know what you're doing.
Well,
and suddenly he makes a decision, and it cascades out of his control into, he's a dead man at the end. You know, it's like, wait, how did I do this? How did I make this bad decision and end up dead?
Well,
John,
I think it's a reflection of your outlook. It's not. I'm not saying it's bad. You've went by it. You came closer to the brass hoop on the merry-go-round of lives than I have. Because I was watching that, and I thought, he's seen rich people. He knows how they are. He understands them better than me. I watched The Counselor. I thought, that's a sick fucking movie. So then I was digging up, and I found Last Rampage. And I thought, that's a sick movie, but it's sort of a white trash kind of
Well, I got a
sick
movie for
you. Know?
I got a sick movie I saw the other night, and I really enjoyed it. It's 1970s. Lucino Visconti, a famous Italian director, and it's called The Damned. And it's about the rise of Nazism in Germany. It gets into the Night of the Long Knives, and it's just all about the internal bloodshed and betrayals and whatnot. Of the rise of Hitler in German society from the point of view of a certain family.
Say the name again, and where did you see it at?
It's simply called The Damned, and when Hitler was elected chancellor, that's when fascism sidled its way into German culture, and of course led to Hitler undergoing what called the Night of the Long Knives against the SA. It's one of its militias that was having aspirations of, taking over from almost like DeSantos and Trump, and that Hitler decided that they had to wipe out the SA, which was run by this General Röhm, who was a World War I vet, but also a very fat homosexual,
Where did you see it?
I saw it on television. I got a DVD of it.
Okay, it's from Netflix?
No. Yeah, I got a Netflix DVD. You get a Netflix DVD. You may be online. I don't know. But Visconti's a very famous director. The Night of the Fizzi Contini's, the one about the leopard with Italy, about with Burt Lancaster as a baron. He's good. About rise of fashion at East Mall.
John Grant.